Thank you so much. Okay. So let me just quickly open up here. Okay, great. So it goes without saying that enduring change is hard. I don't think any of us think that come next year, at this time when we go through the next 40-day period of tshuva and of going through the kinds of introspection and emotions and psychological process that's part of what this amazing part of the Jewish calendar is about. I don't think anybody thinks that we're not going to have to do it again next year at this time. And I wanted to talk a little bit about just some Jewish and psychological perspectives on enduring change. And I'll start with the idea that I started talking a little bit about mistakes as a source of growth. Mistakes as a source of growth. You know, Chazal tell us, "Ein Adam Omed al Divrei Torah, Elim Kein Nichshol Behem." We can't master the words of Torah without struggling. If I was showing you my PowerPoint, if I was sharing the slides, and I'm happy to share the PowerPoint, Tov, if you know, happy to share it at some point in any way that makes the most sense. But let's say I was showing.
Dr. Pavlovitz, if you have it in front of you, you're welcome to share it now. But also no need.
No, I know I'm going to mess it up. Let me not. You know, maybe I will. Let's see. You know what? Let me not. Let me. Wait. Let me just see. Let's see. Slideshow. You know what? Let me go with my gut feeling, and I won't. I think it'll flow better if I'm just talking, and then you know I could post it. I could post it later. Perfect. So yeah. So anyway, if I was showing you the PowerPoint, and every third slide was out of focus, we would remember those slides, the out of focus slides, better than all the other slides, because there's something about again, you know, that nichshol behem, about facing challenge that leads to greater mastery of what we're trying to master. Let me start this section by talking about telling a story about I think the last speech that my father Zal gave. He quoted, they had a big 96th birthday party for him at the Weitschel. He quoted this quotation from Samuel Beckett. "Ever tried, ever failed, no matter, try again, fail again, fail better." Then he went on to say that his goal as his life is coming to an end, because he must have sensed that this was it. His goal was to work in terms of perfecting his midos, work on the ability to fail better. Work on the ability to fail better. So I'll just share with you some things from psychological research. But let me just share with you a talk that an amazing shiva visit that I had during the shiva for my father. Man came to me and my siblings, and he was talking about that quote from Samuel Beckett. And he said that for many years, he was one of the main balei tikkia in the Weitschel. Weitschel, I think, you know, has 10 minyanim, or I forget exactly how many minyanim every during Yom Noram, but he said that he went to my father and he said the pressure is just getting to him. And anybody who's been involved, okay, I know it's an amazing amount of pressure and the fear of failing. So he goes to my father and he says, I don't think I could continue to do this anymore. I think I'm gonna stop being the Baal Tukeya. There are plenty of other people to do it. I just wanted to let you know that I'm stepping down. So my father said, fine. But he said, here's what I want you to do. He says, I want to meet with you a couple times a week. And I want to review with you Hilchos Tkiyas Shofar. And then what I want to do is I want to give a class on Hilchos Tkiyas Shofar. You know, this, you know, the time of year at the beginning of Elul. And I'm going to, based on what we learn, I'm going to ask you to demonstrate for everybody in the shir. We'll demonstrate how not to blow the shofar, how to mess it up. So every time I call, you know, for the various kolos, I'd like you to purposely mess it up. So of course, what happened? He told me there were many people who came to the shir. My father started the demonstration with this man, and he was unable to mess up. He just couldn't mess up. He blew perfectly. That Rosh Hashanah, he went back to being a Baal Tokeya. The power of embracing our mistakes. Next vignette, I want to share with you, some of you have heard me talk about this in the past, it's the story of Dr. Sam Olener. So Olener, which is a very prominent family here in the New York area, including in the five towns. So Sam Olener, when he was a little boy, one horrible, horrible day in his small Polish town that he grew up in, the Nazis, Yimach Shemam, took everybody he ever knew, his father, his mother, his grandparents, his neighbors, his friends, his siblings. They lined them up and they machine gunned them to death. In the chaos, he runs away. And he sees a farm on the outskirts of town, knocks on the door, and the man and woman who answered the door immediately figured out this must be a Jewish child who escaped the massacre going on at the other end of town. And they took him in and they protected him for the entire war. And we all know what would have happened to them had they been caught. Had they been caught, not only would they have been killed, tortured and killed, but their entire family and everybody they knew. The Nazis were merciless about righteous Gentiles. And not only did they treat him like one of their own, but literally they just embraced him with their love. At the end of the war, there was an uncle who had survived, who comes and heard that he was fighting out in this house, and he takes him, brings him to grow up in the five towns. And he goes on and he gets a PhD in sociology, marries a woman who also gets a PhD in sociology. And he spends his entire professional life going back to Europe and interviewing every single righteous Gentile he could find, asking them a simple question. What gave you the unbelievable moral heroism to be able to do what you did? I mean, I've often thought about it. Would I have been able to do it? I'm almost positive that there's no way I would have been able to do that. I mean, what gives birth to a moral giant? It's an important thing to know. It turns out that one of the main predictors of this kind of greatness is how mistakes were handled in the home of a future righteous Gentile. when they made mistakes, and it was inevitable, you can't grow up without making all kinds of mistakes. The parents of the future righteous Gentile met with that mistake calmly, but with a very clear expectation. There was calmness and clarity. Here's what we need you to do in order to engage in a tshuva process, they were told. Let's talk about all the ways that you're not living up to the expectations and the moral code that we've been raising with. There wasn't a bit of anger. It was purely calmness and expectations and a deep belief that we know that you're better than this. We know that you're better than this. And it turned out that the greatness of that righteous Gentile, of every righteous Gentile that they interviewed, and they wrote a series of books, The Old Nurse, was in part at its core how mistakes were handled. You know, we're living at a time that there aren't necessarily great role modeling of how mistakes are handled. Very often there's a defensiveness, there's attacks and counterattacks. And I think that as we are going into the end of the Yom Ha'Orim and going into on Leil Hoshanah Rabbah, going into this the end of this unbelievable period of time, that we have to really think to ourselves about how we handle mistakes that is so incredibly, incredibly important. Okay, so that's that part. Next thing I wanted to talk about, next area I wanted to focus on, is the area of the importance of goals. You know, we're taught in Mishlei, "Ve'ein chazon yifara'am." Without that vision thing, you're going to lose yourself. And I wanted to talk a little bit about goals. I'm going to say a lot of things that many of you have heard me talk about before, but I always benefit for myself from reviewing it. And the first part of goals I wanted to talk about is a little bit about the work of David Brooks, which has become incredibly famous, and what he writes about the importance of having a focus on not resume virtues, but on eulogy virtues. What David Brooks wrote is, we'll be remembered not for our resume virtues, our career achievements, number of graduate degrees and professional skills, but for our eulogy virtues, honesty, gratitude, time spent with family, prioritizing family, friends, and faith. I had an uncle, my father's older brother, his name was Nathan Pelkovitz, and he was a very successful, prominent man. He was somebody who was an officer in World War II in the Air Force. He did all kinds of amazing things during his combat experiences in World War II. And because he spoke, I think, fluent German and was very good with languages, he was very effective at interrogating Nazi soldiers. He then went on and became director of UN policy planning at the State Department, became Adlai Stevenson's speechwriter, and authored numerous books. He was a brilliant man, brilliant, brilliant man, who everybody was incredibly proud of. As a matter of fact, I think, I won't digress. And my Uncle Nathan, if you were at his funeral, which was massive, a massive funeral in the Washington, D.C. area, nobody would have any idea about what he did for a living. Nobody said a word about the fact that he was a professor at Johns Hopkins, that he accomplished unbelievable things in his career. And there's so many stories about some of the amazing things he did in terms of career achievements. Not a word was said about that. the entire funeral and all the hespeda and all the conversations at the shiva was only about what an amazing father he was, what an amazing uncle he was, what an amazing brother he was, his connections with others. And to me, I always think about that when I think about resume virtues as opposed to eulogy virtues. He lived a life that all that mattered at the end was the kind of mensch that he was. And Michael Josephson, the head of the Center for Ethics out in California, he says, here's how you have to live your life. He says, think about, after 120 years, the three ways that you most want to be remembered. Think about, picture yourself after May of Esrim, about the three things that you want the person who's giving your eulogy to say in your eulogy. And then he says, live life backwards. Live life backwards. We have to keep our eye on the ball in terms of goal setting, and in terms of that whole component of giving birth to enduring change, because it's all about that. You know, there's a fascinating study. You know, Hakel and Sukkot, at the end of every 7-year cycle, everybody would come together. And there'd be that kind of connection. Study that I gained a tremendous amount from, and again, I think very important in terms of enduring change, goes like this. We know that the stone tablets, Luchos, were placed at the entrance to Eretz Yisrael at the foot of Har Eval, and it says, Ba'er Hetev. And let me now, Lahavdil, talk about a study that I think brings out this point very clearly. We all know that there's billions of dollars of money lost every year because of fake insurance claims. And it used to be that people would sign the fake insurance claims, but when they'd sign it, there'd be a big box at the bottom of the form that would say, under penalty of perjury, I hereby affirm that everything that I'm saying on this form is true. But they realized they had to do it differently. So they hired a team of mental health specialists, and they did a very simple thing that I think is at the core of this component of the psychology of change. They took that box and they put it at top of the form. So it's now on the very top of the insurance form. So when you sit down to fill out, to make a home insurance claim or some kind of claim tied to water damage or whatever it might be, the big box says, under penalty of perjury, everything I'm about to write here is true. I understand that lying on forms like this leads to higher premiums for everybody, and it goes on to say that. Just that simple change, okay, a cut and paste, putting it on top of the form, led to billions of dollars of savings by the insurance industry. That's the power of clarity, you know. One more thing I wanted to talk about, and just a little bit on the power of stillness as a key to enduring change. In Chicago, I think this was a couple of years ago, Rabbi Dr. Matenke had a fascinating program. And he had people from all walks of life in the Chicago Jewish community, from more modern community schools to Ida Crown, where he was head of school, to yeshivish places. And he had everybody take out their smartphone, and he asked everybody a bunch of questions about what led to stronger spiritual connection in their role as parents and in their roles as Jews. And as people filled it in on this program, there were these huge screens and you'd have bar graphs coming up. And I think just about everybody there was shocked that by far the number one predictor of what people thought was the key to spiritual connection and to the enduring change was stillness, S-T-I-L-L-N-E-S-S. That's called the mamadaka, that still silent voice inside, to find a place where we could look inside, where we could do some cheshbon hanefesh to see what is it that we really want to think about. I mean, that's an amazing part of this pandemic. This pandemic has taken a terrible toll on all of us in different ways. But one of the things in terms of the psychology of change, it's given us the opportunity very often. And if we haven't taken that opportunity, so the fact that we have a much smaller, shorter minyanim now, or many of us are still on lockdown, just to remember that this is a time that we could really develop that aspect of change, of cueing into what's the big picture for us, okay? But it always amazed me that stillness was identified as the most important ingredient in promoting spirituality. Okay, let's go on. In terms of keeping with this goal setting thing, there's the finding in marriages that relationship maintenance, systematically finding time to turn towards each other to see how the marriage is going and to see how each member of the couple is doing in reaching broader goals, both as individuals and as a couple, is associated with marital satisfaction and resilience. This has been a time that, as I'm sure many of us are familiar, people have had that cheshbon hanefesh during the pandemic. And throughout the world, it's led to some people making the decision that I want to end this marriage. But also many people making the decision that, you know what, I'm going to fully commit to this marriage and I'm going to work on it and I'm going to improve it. And that's another key of enduring change. Okay, you know, I love the fact that the Piasetzner Rebbe in Warsaw, during those horrible years of the Holocaust, he used to ask everybody in all of his Talmidim, where do you see yourself in 6 months? How do you want to be different 6 months from now? Okay, and this part is asking yourself, what's your bumper sticker? What's your mission statement? Okay, many of us have heard this thought from the Rav, that we have to ask ourselves in terms of working on our marriage or on other relationships, in terms of relationship as parents, as friends, as children. We have to be able to answer the three questions that Yaakov prepared his family and his army to ask when they were having the fateful encounter with Esau. Who am I? Where am I going? What am I going to do with what I have? And when you even put pen to paper and write down the answers to these questions, and you think about it in a focused kind of way, guess what happens, the research shows. When we focus on the answer to those three questions, who am I, where am I going, what am I going to do with what I have, two things happen. Our happiness levels shoot up, and it makes it more likely that we're going to meet our, actually reach those goals. Fascinating study done by Harvard University. Somebody funded them to answer a simple question. when Talmud Torahs, which is the way many kids in this country, it's the only Jewish education they get, those kids who go to Talmud Torah. So they funded a study at Harvard that asked a simple question. What predicts the top 20 Talmud Torahs in the United States that have the best retention to keep kids all the way through 12th grade? Because if you could keep kids all the way through 12th grade, the chances of intermarriage are much lower in those children. If they drop out after their bar or bat mitzvah, as many, if not most kids do, the chances of intermarriage are very high. So they hired this Harvard team to answer the question. And it's fascinating what they found. You know what the number one predictor is as to whether or not you're going to stay all the way through to 12th grade? It's all about the clarity of expectations. In the top 20 Talmud Torah, where kids stayed all the way through till 12th grade, and because of that, were less likely to intermarry. From the very first day they went to school, this was in preschool, the parents and the head of school would sit down, and the head of school would say, look, you know there are other Talmud Torahs you could send your kids to. We're not a Mickey Mouse Talmud Torah. We really mean business here. If you're going to send your kid here, you have to commit and give us your word that you're going to send your kid here all the way through grade 12. Then as soon as the kids were old enough to understand that, on a regular basis, the head of the Talmud Torah would sit down with those kids, now that they're old enough to understand, and say, you know, this is a special place, but you're committed to staying here through 12th grade. That simple managing of expectations led to really to the answer to assimilation in that subset of the population. Okay, let's move on. Let's talk about, I think this is an important point and an important story that I want to share with you. And it's I think pretty pivotal in terms of what we're talking about. What kind of goals are most likely to be related to happiness? What kind of goals are most likely related to happiness? And here's what we know. There are three characteristics to the kind of goals that are related to happiness. One is intrinsic, okay? As opposed to extrinsic. Intrinsic means that it's coming from inside of you. It's coming because this is your signature strength. It's what you love to do. It's at your core. It's not coming because of outside pressure. It's coming because of an inside goal that you have, coming from something deep in your neshama. That's number one. Number two, it's authentic, not coming from expectations of family or society. And number three, it's approach rather than avoidance. Anytime a goal is characterized by challenge versus threat, you do much better. And I'm going to share with you a story that I've always been, and I apologize if you've heard it before, but it's, I think, a fascinating story in terms of this experience. I was in the Southern Hemisphere, and I was asked to give a talk there. And somebody pointed out to me, hey, you see that guy? And I see this guy. He's a world-renowned physician. And he's a world-renowned surgeon. He's known to be an amazing, amazing diagnostician. And he's known to be one of the leading leading doctors in the world. You know, I've seen him on the cover of Newsweek and Time magazine. And, you know, he's in papers all the time. And I felt like, wow, it's amazing. I'm giving a talk and the guy's right there. It was just, I don't know, it was cool to see such a famous guy. After I give the talk and I was talking about this topic, he comes and he has to see me and he's teary. He's crying a little bit. And he takes me into a private room in this shul and he tells me the following. He says, when I was a little boy, all I wanted to do was to grow up to be an architect. I dreamed constantly about the buildings I would build to change the skyline of this city. So I thought about it. I carried around with me a little booklet, and I sketched all of the buildings that I was going to basically transform the landscape here with. And I hit the age that I was going to start my architectural training, which is the European model, which is what the Southern Hemisphere uses, comes at a pretty early age. What here would be high school. And he tells his parents, I'm so excited, I'm going to start my training as an architect. And they look at him, he's an only child, and they say, you will be a doctor. And he says, no, I'm going to be an architect. And they say, no, you'll be a doctor. Doctors make much more money. Architects don't make nearly as much money. We're old people. We need you to support us when we're older. And he was devastated. Back in those days, kids listened to their parents. And he goes on, and he becomes this world-famous doctor. But here's where he gets to the point of why he wanted to talk to me. He goes into his suit jacket, and he takes out a little notebook, spiral notebook, and he shows me all these buildings that he's been sketching. He says, I'm still sketching nonstop. It's all I think about, all I dream about. But I now know that these are the buildings that will never be built. And he breaks down into tears and walks away. So I told this story over at a Jewish medical ethics conference. And almost immediately, about 40, 50 doctors gather around me and start yelling at me. Here's what they say. They said, do you know what a disaster would be for the world if this man had not been a doctor? He had an unusual mind. Maybe it was because he had the mind of an architect. He was able to develop all of these devices, and he was able to think in a way that was novel. Because his parents insisted on his becoming a doctor, you know how many, they said, I think hundreds of thousands of people are alive today who would not be alive. They said, do you know what a disaster would have been for humanity if his parents had let him follow his heart? So I don't have the answer to this. I just wanted to present it as a chakira to think about. I truly don't have the answer, and I think we can make an argument in different ways, but I'll just end with this beautiful thought from Rav Kook that summarizes this, okay? About goals and the importance of intrinsic goals. I certainly have a hard time living my life this way, but it's not a bad goal to have, to hold this high is a banner to strive towards. Yesh ben chorin sharucha rosh alevet. There are free people who have the spirit of a slave. Yesh eved sharucha malei acheros. And there are slaves who have the spirit filled with freedom. Hanemon latzmiyuso ben chorin hu. Anybody who's faithful to their inner essence is always going to be a free person. Somebody whose whole life is about what's good in the eyes of others, whoever, will always be a slave. That's intrinsic motivation. That's what we have to strive for. Okay, I think I'm going to go now to some thoughts on habit and enduring change. It's actually the core question that we have here for our remaining 15 minutes. Okay, here's what the research shows. That when you look at what gives birth to enduring change as opposed to passing change. So let's say we had a whole week of YU Torah lectures during this week. And it was going nonstop, and a lot of very practical recommendations as you've been hearing all night. What you would find is about a third of people will hear it and find it interesting, but they'll make no enduring change. They'll go on with their lives as if nothing happened. Another third will make change, but it'll only last a month or so. But then there's another third that will make enduring change that won't stop. Will make permanent change. Okay, more or less permanent change. And what they find is the key difference in predicting who's in that final group of enduring change is making the change a habit, somehow ritualizing it. That's the beauty of this time of year. Okay? Part of the beauty of the Cheshbon and Nefesh we've been going through and the whole period of introspection is it's built into our calendar, especially if we take it seriously. And when we make it happen, for example, if you do a count your blessing exercise every Friday night, here are three things I want to do, three things I'm grateful for from the week, three things that three ways that I want to do chesed or receive chesed, the ultimate superpower in terms of change. All of those things, that kind of habit built into our daily kind of ritual is key. Okay. And then we've been hearing about tiny habits. So there's a fascinating book that came out just this past year by Dr. Fogg, F-O-G-G, called Tiny Habits, The Small Habits That Change Everything. Definitely a book worth getting. And what Dr. Fogg talks about is if you just make tiny, tiny little changes, okay? It may mean focusing, okay, there's one tefillah I'm going to really focus on in terms of more kavana, or one way of stealing time with my wife, with my husband, with my child in a way that I didn't in the past. And maybe all it will be is a five-minute conversation, okay? One of the things Dr. Fogg talks about is put on your running shoes if you're looking to start exercising that way, and walking just one block at a time, or flossing one tooth at a time, and then build on that. And their research shows at Stanford University, which is one of the leading psychology centers in the world, that small change leads to massive kinds of permanent change over time. Okay, I'm just going to end with the Medrash HaGadol, because it talks about pushing ourselves. And I'll just end with it. And many of you know this Medrash, but I just love it. So, and I think it's a good way to end. So I'll just, I won't do the Hebrew. I'll just do the English, okay? It goes like this. So it said of Rabbi Akiva that he was 40 years old. He had never learned Torah. So he marries the daughter of Kalva Sabu, as we all know. She told him, go and learn in Yerushalayim. He answered, I'm 40. How can I accomplish this? Okay. And this is a famous story where she says, this look at this stone, this running brook that had become eroded. And she said, it's the constant pressure of the water led to the erosion. Here's where the story becomes amazing in the Medrash. Okay. He says to her, as she's pushing him to go and start to learn, he says, people are going to laugh at me. I'm 40, know nothing. And almost like I picture him going off to pre-K with these little kids and sitting in those desks that you can't fit in if you're an adult. Okay? She said, let me show you something wondrous, she tells him. So she asked her husband to bring her a donkey. And the donkey had been injured in its spine. It has a spinal stenosis, leaving a depression in the center of its back. She proceeded to fill it with soil, plant within it cress. Cress is a plant that grows very fast, and it sprouted. And then Rav Akiva was then instructed to take the donkey to the marketplace. So he's not sure what she wants from him, but he knows she's wise. He listens to her. So he takes his donkey with the flower plot in its in the middle of its back. And when people saw it, the strange spectacle, the first day they laughed as they did the second day. By the third day, the Medrash Rabbah tells us, they no longer laughed. Okay? So what would happen is this children who had been throwing things at Rav Akiva and taunting him, asked their fathers and asked their mothers, what's that weird man walking with the donkey with the flower pot in the middle? And now the answer is, look, there are different kinds of donkeys in the world. There are regular donkeys. And then there are donkeys that have a flower pot in the middle of their back with a crest growing out of it. The next day, the Medrash tells us, he packs his lunch, goes off with his son to start the famous Odyssey that to this very day has changed the way we live. Let me just do one final thought in our final 5 minutes. And that's the power of tears, the power of tears, okay? So Gansfried, the author of the Ketzer Shulchan Aruch, says that when it says in the Pasuk, "Umol Hashem Elokecha eslevavcha veslevav zarecha," that plays out, that umol, without the pain of umol and feeling of a deep regret that includes tears, there's no tshuva gemara. Or like Rabbi Lamb Zatzal said, the act of crying, according to Rabbi Lamb, is the beginning of transformation. The tears are those of protest and resolute purpose. Revolvi spoke every year of Yom Kippur about the need to be mekabel something to change in the coming year. And he said that you can only be mekabel something when you cry. And we're living now at a time of tears, at a time of challenge, at a time of loss. I don't think there's anybody listening to this call who hasn't experienced some kind of loss. It might be of a family member, it might be of a community member, and it's the loss of our regular way of life, of the simple pleasure of being able to hug a grandchild who's not living with us, and the simple pleasure of being able to go to shul and shake a good friend's hand. And it's a time of tears, a time of loss. But I'll just end with a sense of hope, and that's that if you cried tears of allergies this morning, and I took the tears that you shed because you have an allergy, and I put them under a microscope, the chemical composition of those tears would be salt and water. Salt and water. Okay? But let's say you cry emotional tears. That's part of what Hoshana Rabbah is about, is part of what this whole period of time is about. And you took those emotional tears and you put them under a microscope. They'll contain cortisol. They'll contain a stress hormone. And I think that's the final point that I want to leave us with. It's the power of being able to cue into our emotions in a genuine kind of way, and to use that as an engine for change. And I'll just end with the beautiful Medrash I learned from Rabbi Dr. Fox. It says, in Brachos Rabbah, Kol B'Kivui, everything, when we're going through a tough time, should be dealt with Kivui, with hope. It should be dealt with hope and promise. The word tikva is tied to the word kav, or a rope. We're never dangling in the wind alone at the mercy of the current. We're not alone. We're connected to God. We're connected to our family. We're connected to our community. Medrash says, Yisurin b'kivui. Yisurin, suffering, has to be dealt with hope. Geula, our ultimate redemption, is also with kivui. And may we all be zoche to have, as we've come to the end of Yontif, to have a year filled with hope and connection and everything that our beautiful religion gives us. and to hopefully this year figure out a way to connect in an enduring way to the truths of what this period of the year is all about. Thank you, everybody.